The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 121, a paper entitled, Not Just a Question of Numbers, Defining Mormonism Yesterday and Today, by Jan Shipps.
Mormonism, the story of a new religious tradition. And as you'll learn today, that does not mean a new world religion. But Jan has served every job you can in Mormonism. It's like she's the Religious Society president par excellence. She's been the president of the Mormon History Association. She is currently the president of the John Whitmer Historical Association, which is a history organization primarily for the Community of Christ, formerly the Reorganized Church. She has another book that she'd asked me to mention to you. It's called Sacred Landscape Intention, colon. Of course there's a colon. Religion and the Public Life in the American West. She edited this collection of essays and wrote the introduction and the conclusion. And since most of us live in the West, we might enjoy that. In the last decade, Mormon studies has become a hot issue in the academy or among academics. And a representation of that fact is that recently Jan was elected as president-elect of the American Society of Church History. She's the first Mormon, first person whose career has been in Mormon history to be elected to that position. And it just shows how important Mormonism is becoming as a study among non-Mormon academics. And Jan Shipps has been a vital part in making that, and putting Mormonism on the agenda of academics. And that is why we are here today, to listen to her. Jan.
Let's give her applause.
At this point, can you hear? At this point, I have been around so long that I never know whether you want to hear me read a paper or just to tell stories. But I think I will to begin with one story, and it has to do with how difficult it might be to be an outsider and to become a person who studies Mormon, who does Mormon studies. And I thought of this last night as I watched Laurie Maffley Kipp read that paper. In the very first Sunstone Symposium, I was one of the speakers I was a plenary speaker in one of those, that very first Sunstone Symposium, and I told this story. In the summer of 1973, Leonard Arrington and Davis Bitten and Jim Allen were trying to identify people who wanted to study Mormonism and who could come and use the archives. And they had a system where they could give you a fellowship to do the summer. And they gave me a fellowship to come out here and spend the summer doing Mormon studies. It was a time when everything was very, very casual. As you know, we had just gotten over the 60s, and it was very casual. And I started looking around and said, how can I go to Salt Lake City? I don't own a dress. And so I went to the local penny store, and I bought three dresses. And I brought them out here to wear for that summer of working in the archives. And I wore one, and then the next, and then the next, and then I would start over and wear these dresses. And when it came time for me to go home on that last day, many of the people who were here, including Davis and Jim and Leonard and Klaus Hansen and any number of other Latter-day Saints, said they wanted to take me to lunch. And we were coming out of the archives, as you know, it used to be upstairs in the second floor. Now it is now down. It's going to be downstairs, the archives reading room. But we were standing there, and just as we were waiting for the elevator to come, I said, "Aren't you guys proud of me? I have been here all summer, and I have worn a dress every day, and you would never know that I was not a Mormon." And everybody in the crowd laughed and laughed. Guess why? Every dress was sleeveless. It is only after you've had experience after experience like this that you begin to know what it is to study Mormonism and to study this culture. So, Laurie, next time, if the brethren are there, wear sleeves. Okay. Okay, I want to warn you that a part of what I'm going to read today was given at the Library of Congress conference last spring. And so if any of you were there, it may be deja vu all over again, but I'm going to read it anyway, but I'm going to start with a description of that conference. An imposing conference marking the bicentennial of the first Mormon prophet's birth was held at the Library of Congress last spring. The theme of this much-publicized and high-profile event was the Worlds of Joseph Smith, and most of the sessions concentrated directly on the Mormon prophet. There were sessions on Joseph Smith in his own time, his recovery of past worlds, his presence in his own and the personal world of others, and the challenge he mounted to the theological world of his own day. Although it was described in the program as Joseph Smith and the Making of a Global Religion, the final session of the conference, the one in which I was a participant, was not focused so much on the prophet as on what happened to the religious movement that he brought into being. Is it, in fact, a global faith, a new world religion? If not, how should it best be characterized? This was a main thrust of the final session's principal paper, which was presented by the English scholar Douglas Davies. It was also the key issue that I addressed in my remarks. In order to have truth in advertising, I'd better say that much of what I will say here today is an expansion of those remarks. But in this Sunstone presentation, I intend to delve more deeply into this matter of how best to define and classify Mormonism historically as how best to characterize contemporary Mormonism. Before turning to that task, however, in addition to describing the final session of the, quote, International Academic Conference at the Library of Congress, remember that note, Academic Conference, as this event was described in the broadside announcements that were placed on the web and mailed to great numbers of scholars of religion and history, it will be helpful to consider the structure of the entire conference that was held in the nation's capital in order to get at what exactly was going on in Washington land. Only then will it be possible for me to clarify the message, the programming of a capstone session on Mormonism as a global religion seems clearly to have intended to convey. Jointly sponsored by the Library of Congress of the United States and Brigham Young University, but primarily organized at BYU, this much-advertised and very public symposium held Joseph Smith up to public view and put Mormonism forward as a legitimate member of the World Religion Club. At the same time, it also put forward three prominent LDS scholars and a distinguished general authority on display. In the case of the scholars, Richard Bushman, Terrell Givens, and David Paulson, Three commentators were invited to respond to their papers, and in two of the sessions, two of the three respondents were non-Mormons. In the other, only one was a non-Mormon. There were no respondents to the paper given by Elder Dallin Oaks. Surprise, surprise. The final session departed from this pattern in many ways. In the first three sessions, the first Mormon prophet was very much there, virtually in the room, in the world, if not of it. In the session on Joseph Smith and the making of a global religion, the prophet virtually disappeared as the manner of how Mormonism is or is not a global religion was addressed. Initially, in the early months, the announcement of the conference on the web identified the scholarly headliner for this session as Rodney Stark. This eminent sociologist, as you all know, whose predictions about the phenomenal growth of the membership of the LDS Church and about how Mormonism could well become the first new world religion since the appearance of Islam in the 6th century, had become very much a favorite with Latter-day Saints. He was slated to give the major paper in this session. Along with the configuration of the earlier sessions, this choice of topic and speaker gave away the secret that the conference itself, and especially this final session, was clearly triumphalist in character. Now, what do I mean by triumphalist scholarship or triumphalist rhetoric? The best way I can explain is to make a comparison with the scholarship and rhetoric of mainline Protestantism at the beginning of the 20th century. Albert Outler, the greatest 20th century scholar of American Methodism, you know I would talk about Methodism, once came to our Methodist church in Bloomington, Indiana, to talk about what had happened in the 20th century to mainline Protestantism in general and to Methodism in particular. He talked about how the 19th century had been the Methodist century, but how, during the first decade of the 20th century, the Baptist had passed the Methodist in numbers of members. Notwithstanding that disappointment, he told his listeners, and this paper was given before I got to Bloomington, but I do have a tape of it. He told his listeners how he and his siblings had been excited by what was happening as mainline Protestantism was spreading all across the nation and as it was sending great masses of missionaries to many foreign lands. It was a heady time, he said, for American Protestants in the mainline. He and all his compatriots in Sunday schools and churches, and sometimes maybe even in sermons, agreed that the world would become Protestant before the passing of their generation. They simply expected mainline Protestant to be the religion of the world. After all, they were living in the Christian century, a time that had supplied the name to the major periodical of the Mormon faith. And if you read the Christian Century today, it still is about mainline Protestantism, but it is also very much about evangelicalism. It is very much about Catholicism and even much about Judaism. And every once in a while, when I get around to writing an article about the Mormons, just as the numerical preeminence of the historical Protestant mainstream was going down, the eminent sociologist whose predictions about the growth of church membership and how Mormonism could well become the next major new world religion arose. It was like one went down, one disintegrated, and one went up. The membership fortunes of the Church of Jesus Christ started to soar at an astonishing rate, and they really did. Whereas decline became the normal condition for Methodists, American Baptists, Presbyterians, the United Church of Christ, Episcopalians, Lutherans, and Disciples of Christ, growth fantastic growth became the normal condition for the mountain saints. And I make it very clear here that I'm talking about the mountain saints and not the prairie saints. In many ways, the prairie saints, that is, the Community of Christ and other Mormons who did not come west, were experiencing the same kind of decline that was happening in the mainline churches. By 1965, growth was the, underlined and capitalized, was the Mormon story. And the same sort of excitement, even exhilaration, that had been a part of the lived religion in the Protestant mainstream early in the century now became a part of Mormon life in the Mountain West. Gradually, the thrill and elation that accompanied being a part of such a successful religious enterprise became so routine that it seemed that it would always be present in the lives of Latter-day Saints. The stories of how the church, struggling to cope with the explosion in membership and geographic expansion, became commonplace. It was, for Latter-day Saints, the same sort of heady time that the growth of mainline Protestantism had been in the early part of the 20th century. By 1984, when Professor Stark started writing about the Mormon faith and its institutional structure, predicting such a remarkable future for a church that could well become the new Christianity, a new form of Christianity, the Latter-day Saints were a prepared people. With the Public Affairs Department ready and able to spread the word, the Saints began to tell the world about their success in attracting converts, not simply in the United States, but all outside the United States as well. Although by no means integrated into the formal belief structure of the church, an informal but pervasive conviction developed and was added to how the saints understood the faith. And this is the conviction. The church is true because it is so successful in attracting new members into the communion of saints. Somehow or other, in the minds of many persons, growth and the truth of Mormonism got connected. In recent years, the Church of Jesus Christ has passed the Presbyterians, Lutherans, Congregationalists, and Disciples of Christ all together, growing so fast that it has become the fourth largest church in the United States, after the Roman Catholics, the Southern Baptist, and the United Methodist. But I just read a day or two ago that the United Methodist, after having about 3 years of growth, had started to decline again. Yet there are fewer Latter-day Saints in the United States than there are elsewhere in the world, supposedly. No wonder many came to believe that the saints' triumphalist attitude and its accompanying rhetoric was justified. In light of this, it is not surprising that the organizers of the Bicentennial Conference in Washington selected Rodney Stark to be the headliner, the last major intellectual commentator on Joseph Smith and the making of a global faith. Despite the fact that the LDS Church passed the 12 million member milestone, a few signs started to appear here and there, intimating that, with regard to church growth, all might not be as well in Zion as many thought and as the Public Affairs Department seemed to suggest, and as the Olympics seemed to exist as well. Brief references to the difficulty of retaining members, allusions to problems with the missionary force, missionaries being sent home and so forth, references to combining wards and to temples that do not attract as many saints as expected, led to questions about the accuracy of the yearly report of the number of members. Young sociologist at professional meetings began to offer papers questioning Professor Stark's conclusions, especially on the basis of retention. Materials suggesting that the church's numbers are not trustworthy started to appear on unofficial LDS blogs. Whether any of this had to do with the fact that it turned out that Professor Stark discovered a subsequent engagement that prevented him from being at the Library of Congress program is not clear. But the final program had to do with a different headliner. Now, of course, we have the real story, as the Tribune told us on Tuesday, as Peggy Fletcher Stack has gathered all this information together and made it clear that the number of members on the rolls and the number of active saints is, there's a discrepancy that is very, very, very great. Maybe one in three, she suggests, is active, which would make not 12 million Latter-day Saints, but 4 million. In presenting the main paper in that final session of the Library of Congress Conference, the British scholar Douglas Davies, who had been asked to take Rodney Stark's place, set the agenda by addressing the quantitative aspects of church growth. Exactly how big is this LDS phenomenon, he asked. This was before Peggy's article. Is it continuing to grow as rapidly as it did in the last half century? If not, why not? What qualitative dynamics are fostering church growth and constraining its unified flourishing? Those are some direct quotes from his paper. This question of church growth was also the main one addressed by the next speaker in the session, Professor Gerald McDermott from Virginia. Although his presentation was billed as a response to Professor Davies, that was not exactly what it was, if you want to know the inside story, because Professor McDermott did not have Professor Davies' paper before him when his remarks were prepared. In fact, nobody told Professor McDermott that Rodney Stark would not be there, and he was under the impression that he would be responding to paper given Stark, and so he consequently presented a challenge to Stark's conclusions, arguing that those conclusions were faulty because they were based on straight-line projections, statistical projections, that is, compound interest projections, that rested on the overall rate of church growth between 1930 and 1980. McDermott made reference to the sociologist's failure to take retention rates into account, something also noted by several young sociologists at the last meeting of the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion. And on the basis of this significant issue, as well as several others, McDermott argued that it is much too soon to assume that Mormonism will be the next new world religion. In getting ready to prepare my response to Professor Davies' paper, an early version of the paper of which I had before me, I also had the rapid numerical and geographic expansion in mind, and I had checked the growth rate not between 1930 and 1980, but year by year in the last 20 years. And instead of a rate of 50% or something like that, I was finding rates of 3%, 4%, 5%. Actually, I didn't do it. The gentleman who teaches Sunday school with me is a nuclear physicist, and I said, Ed, I got to have these numbers, and he gave them to me. This was not, however, the first time I had considered this matter. In an article I wrote for the Christian Century in 1980, I had said this, that Mormonism might ever become the national religion seems far-fetched. This is 1980. Yet, in view of its amazing growth in its first 150 years, it is not without interest to note that an LDS mathematician recently made a half-joking but statistically correct projection. This is Ned Hill from who's now at BYU, and he did this for me, and he said that, quote, if Mormonism continues to grow at its present rate, then in another 150 years when Mormonism celebrates its tricentennial, all the nation's citizens will be Mormons. I added to that statement the perils of ecclesiastical success and the difficulty of predicting the birth rate make questionable the accuracy of this extrapolation. I did not mention the problem of retention at that point, but the retention of converts was an issue that I dealt with in another venue as I compared conversion to a sifter. Many converts fill up the sifter, but not all go through. And I think that's a useful metaphor to think about how Mormonism works. Now, to turn to the difference between a new world religion and a new religious tradition, and because it is the bicentennial, what Joseph Smith had to do with either one, I want to change and look at this issue. In the sense that the gospel vision was expansive enough to impel his sending members of the Council of the Twelve as missionaries to England and continental Europe, and even sending Orson Hyde to Jerusalem, Joseph Smith put down the foundations for reaching out to the entire world. Yet when he was murdered in 1847, Mormonism essentially remained an indigenous North American faith. The prophet was not present when Mormonism became what the conference organizers described as a world religion or a global religion. And Professor Davis made a distinction because he said a world religion is all over the world and it is integrated into cultures all over the world, whereas a global faith is in many places across the world but not entirely integrated into the culture. It sits on the culture. There's a host culture, but in a global faith, religions maintain their integrity with what they were before they arrived in a new culture. And Professor Davis was very good on that point. As is well known, following the splintering of the Mormon movement that occurred after Smith's death, the largest body of the saints followed Brigham Young to the Mountain West. Once settled in the Great Salt Lake Valley, they again became very serious about spreading the gospel to foreign parts. Missionaries were sent to the British Isles, all through the Northern Europe, and even to the South Seas. But as Mormonism was still in its gathering phase, still living in the winding up scene, the church's missionaries encouraged all those who could do so, all those who accepted the gospel, to join the body of the saints in the Great Basin Kingdom. Establishing the Perpetual Immigration Fund and helping in many other ways, the church assisted converts in getting to the valley in the tops of the mountains. Leonard Arrington and many other scholars who have paid close attention to the life of Brigham Young have argued convincingly that as the Lion of the Lord presided over the saints in the inner mountain region, he turned his beloved Joseph's prophetic vision into reality. In doing so, he created a kingdom that turned on its head the situation the saints had faced as long as they were in the United States. Before they departed the boundaries of the U.S., they had lived in a land that, despite the separation of church and state, was a virtual Protestant establishment. In the West, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints became the established church. Other religious bodies were tolerated in much the same way that sects, that's with a CT, not an X, that sects were tolerated in European countries with established churches. Consequently, for at least a decade, the kingdom was truly their own, a Mormon theocratic state, and to some of the saints, the millennium seemed just over the next horizon. When the U.S. government sent the Army to intervene in the kingdom building process in 1856 and 1857, Brigham Young directed the church's foreign missionaries to return to their home base in the Intermountain West. Shall I do that? For the saints, but the saints never lost sight of the injunction, both in the New Testament and in revelations given through Joseph Smith that were recorded in the Doctrine and Covenants, instructing the 12 to go into all the world, and in whatsoever place ye cannot go, ye shall send missionaries, so that the testimony may go from you into all the world unto every nation. Smith's initial prophetic vision had been that the gathering of the saints would make possible the building of the New Jerusalem in Jackson County, Missouri, a place that would have a temple at its center. But events transpired such that the gathering had to be continued after the saints left Missouri and Illinois, and after the temples being built in Utah had become the center of God's earthly kingdom. As a result, the geographical trajectory from periphery to center was maintained until the early decades of the 20th century. The church was not so much a global faith as a faith in which people were converted and maybe stayed where they were until they could get their things in order and come to the Mountain West. Moreover, although many vibrant Latter-day Saint congregations were established outside the Intermountain West, the Mormon world was still, by and large, divided into the kingdom and the mission field until well after the end of World War II. This faith community's construction of as a truly significant player on the global religious scene really began during the presidency of David O. McKay, 1951 to 1970. As we can tell from the new biography of his church administration that has just been published by the University of Utah Press, his attention program was exceedingly important. He was also concerned with an building agenda to the creation of a correlation program that in time would function to ensure that Mormonism would be the same no matter where it materialized with enough strength and vitality to be organized into wards and stakes. And his circumnavigation of the globe, that is President McKay, were all essential elements in beginning the transformation of Mormonism from tradition to global religious. He carried this transformation forward in the presidency of Spencer Kimball in 1998 when a new revelation stood ordination available to all fields, thereby practically the entire administration of Gordon B. Hinckley, including the many years of service as president, has been to completing the convert would make his church and its gospel universal enough to be at home in myriad places, different cultures. The history of 20th century Mormonism to be written, but armchairs seem to agree that the growth and geographical expansionism is primarily due to program initiatives and to policies of President Young, President McKay, President Kimball, and Hinckley, not to the prophet Joseph Smith. If this is the case, we have a session on Joseph Smith's religion. Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, and so on, as well as religions that have passed for the scene and are now from the scene and are now artifactual religious traditions. These dimensions are the mythological, the doctrinal, the ritual, the social, the institutional, the ethical, and the experiential. Once the experiential, that is, having real, more profound, disclosive religious experience like the first vision or how people come to believe that the Book of Mormon is what it claims to be after reading Moroni 10:4. These dimensions, once this dimension of this agenda was set, the data I had gathered in the previous 20 years of research convinced me that in Mormonism, not only do all six dimensions of religion exist, but they are also distinctive quite different in very clearly defined ways from all other forms of Christianity and from Judaism. Added to the book of the biblical story, the Book of Mormon enriches the mythological dimension of Mormonism, a dimension that is also augmented by the life stories of those who first believed. Mormon doctrine is, you know, in the same way that the New Testament does for Christianity. Mormon doctrine is distinctive both in its character and in the way it was settled, not through conciliar deliberations, but by way of revelation. The building of a temple rather than a church in Kirtland and the prophet's translation of the Bible and other texts generated the development of a unique configuration of ritual practice as well as a particularly distinctive theology. Mormon social patterns were profoundly affected by the introduction of plural marriage, and although Mormon's ecclesiastical manifestations resembled Catholicism and certain forms of Christian primitivism, its priesthood structure and lay clergy made the social institutional dimension of the Mormon religion exceptional as well. Except for the word of wisdom, the ethical dimension of Mormonism is not as atypical as are all the other dimensions of this religion. But that is a huge exemption because one of the functions of the word of wisdom has been and has always been that it signifies sainthood. It tells people from the outside that you are a saint. The gathering and the subsequent creation of a Mormon village lifestyle, even in the urban areas of the Great Intermountain Mormon Corridor, made the everyday finally that part of the experiential dimension of religion that forged connections between the divine and the human realms was so often characterized by the sorts of revelation that Elder Oaks described the night before I gave this paper, that plus the oft-described revelatory response to Moroni 10:4, that the experiential dimension of religion in Mormonism is likewise exceptional. It is not a born-again experience, or it is rarely a born-again experience. It was both comparable to and different from the experiential dimensions of other religious faiths. Separating these six dimensions in this manner is artificial, but the way they work together to create a peculiar people with a shared language and symbol system is an indication that Mormonism is more than a cult, a sect, a denomination, or a church. It is a religious tradition, one that was new when it came into being in the 19th century, and here is one answer to what Joseph Smith had to do with the making of the global religion, and that is that it is still a separate religious tradition, and the Mormon prophet was absolutely central to the creation of virtually all of the dimensions of religion. Whether its source was the Golden Plates or some inspired production process, the Book of Mormon came forth through the agency of Joseph Smith. He was a seer and translator as well as prophet, and as one who spoke for God, Smith was likewise the agent through which the revelations that established the church's theology and doctrine were introduced. The fundamental ritual patterns were also established through prophetic action. Although the architectural plans of the social and institutional and even the ethical structures of the saints turned into reality came through prophecy, Smith was, one might say, the general contractor of that structure. His leadership was practical and far-sighted as well as prophetic. Without him, Mormonism, had it lasted, would be something else entirely. What he did single-handedly, he was the originator, designer, and engineer responsible for the creation of this new religious tradition. The connection between Joseph Smith and Mormonism as a religious tradition is absolutely central. Even though this fairly firmly established, many new religious movements never get beyond the stage of being led by a charismatic leader. The leader's death spells the eventual demise of the movement. That this did not happen in the wake of Joseph Smith's death may well be his greatest contribution to the making of modern Mormonism. That is, a Mormonism that does not remain more or less encapsulated in particular cultural and geographic spaces, but is able to move beyond those spaces, is important. It is not like the Shakers, as an example. As if this were not enough, Joseph Smith made one more contribution of inestimable worth in the making of Mormonism as something more than another idiosyncratic Christianity. Another feature of Smith's role as an unfathomable director of what occurred emerges. Early in his role as prophet, the role of prophet was conflated with his role as priest. Now, conflation means two things get mixed up, as you do when you blow up a balloon. It can't be separated. As prophet priest, he was likewise the president of the church as well as the president of the high priesthood. This meant that unlike many other religious systems brought into being by charismatic leaders, Mormonism had three quite separate streams of authority already in place when Smith was murdered. The organization of the church was complete enough that the mantle of the prophet did not have to fall on a new charismatic leader in order for the movement to survive. The priesthood was already there, and so was. I know I've got. I'm on the last page. I'm watching. I was supposed to go. I was going an hour, and then we could talk. Of equal significance, because of this roles of prophet and priest, Mormonism was not constrained by the need to wait until some extended routinization of charisma happened for the tradition to get on with the business of carrying the gospel to the world. In the end, it is critical not to overlook the reality that Joseph Smith was a charismatic figure and that it was through his agency that the heavens were opened and the divine once again spoke in a language that humans could understand. Without the reopening of that conversation, Mormonism would likely be just one more restoration movement that started out, as did the Disciples of Christ, claiming to be the only true Church of Jesus Christ, but all too quickly becoming just another denomination. Although something like this might be happening in the Community of Christ, there seems to be little danger that something of that nature could happen to the Mormonism of the Mountain Saints. But it's too soon to know what is likely to happen to the Church of Jesus Christ and Joseph Smith. What appears to this Mormon watcher is that at present, its categorical home is somewhere between a world religion, a great world religion, and a religious tradition. And it seems to me that a better analog than early Christianity is that it could be like Judaism, everywhere in the world, but separate from the host culture in which it resides. Thank you.
Is it the 90-minute session?
Oh, I don't know. I thought it was.
Is this a 90 or a 60-minute session?
60.
Well, thank you for coming. I just want to note that Jan has reached the status of Dallin Oaks where she speaks without a respondent.
I thought it was a 90-minute session.
It doesn't matter. You're right on time.
Yeah. No, I'm done.
Online. I wasn't able to go.